Building Bridges with Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash.
We present part two in our interview of the Reverend William Barber on creating a fusion movement to defeat Trump and move forward together.
Earlier this year, Reverend Barber announced an effort by faith and moral leaders to carry forward Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s dream of a poor people's campaign working across 25 states to alleviate the triad forces of poverty, militarism, and racism that Dr. King knew were poisoning our country then and still threaten us today.
The Reverend Dr. William Barber is pastor of Greenleaf Christian Church in Goldsboro, North Carolina, and architect of the Forward Together moral movement that gained national acclaim with its Moral Monday protests, in which drew tens of thousands of North Carolinians and other moral witnesses to the state legislature. He has served as president of the North Carolina NAACP, the largest state conference in the South. His two most recent books include Forward Together and The Third Reconstruction.
And Dr. Barber is the founder and president of Repairers of the Breach, an organization that seeks to build a progressive agenda rooted in a moral framework to counter the ultra-conservative constructs that try to dominate the public sphere. Reverend Barber is one of the most influential progressive religious figures in the country.
15 in the union was the cry throughout the country. Really, I think that's just the beginning, and I think that you're on the right track in terms of a poor people's movement to take off from where Dr. King left off in 1968. So why don't you flesh out your vision for a poor people's movement and talk about where you're and we're going with it?
Actually, unions really began in some ways to address the issue of poverty. And you remember in 63, the March on Washington was the march for jobs and justice, jobs and civil rights. In 67, Dr. King said in November there needed to be a poor people's campaign to address the triple evils of racism, materialism, and militarism, and then brought together people like Sheila Chavez, Albert Shirley, and the Jewish Federation, the welfare groups, to engage in a sustained encampment and civil disobedience in the nation's capital. In the times in which we're living now, where we have a narcissistic egomaniac in the White House who is a symptom of a larger problem, in a time in which we have 37 million people still without health care, 102 million working poor and working poor people, 250,000 people dying every year from poverty, where we're seeing the rise of white supremacy, not just in the horrific death that happened in Charlottesville, but in the policies and the agenda that's being promoted by Richard Spencer and others, where they want to deport immigrant brothers and sisters and promote rolling back voting laws. And we have somebody like Jeff Sessions in the Attorney General slot. But we were saying, my friends, that we would need to have a poor people's campaign even if Hillary Clinton had been elected or President Obama was still the president, because we are doing an audit. The Souls of Poor Folk audits America since 1968. And the reality is we've still not brought ourselves to really deal with these issues. We had 26 presidential debates, Democrat and Republican, this past election season for the presidency. Not 1 hour on poverty. Not 1 hour where working poor people were asking the questions. Not 1 hour on the war economy. Not 1 hour on systemic racism. We didn't even have 1 hour debate on restoring the Voting Rights Act. And so what we're doing is we're organizing in 25 states plus the District of Columbia and saying that for 40 days out of the 305 days next year, we should be able to come together and organizing a number of people in each state who will engage in sustained civil disobedience around an agenda that will be announced called the Souls of Poor Folk Agenda, and to address systemic racism, poverty, ecological devastation, the war economy. Now, lastly, how are we getting these 25 states and why the District of Columbia, why 40 days? Because we're not ending a Poor People's Campaign. We're not really having a commemoration of 50 years ago. We're talking about launching a poor people's campaign and changing the moral narrative in this country. We have mapped, finally, and looked at, if you look at the states that have had the worst voter suppression, that's racism, the worst voter suppression since 2010, and put those on a map and overlay that with poverty, lack of living wages, low wages, low labor density, a bad law for the environment, bad law for immigrants, they are the same states. If you use the penetration point of voter suppression and racism, you find that the same states that have engaged in voter suppression and racism are the same states that have been blocking union rights and living wages. So it's an intersectional fusion movement that I believe we have to have to reinvigorate the movement, not commemorate what happened 50 years ago, but to build a movement that will launch next year and continue.
And I can't help but just ask your thoughts on two things. You know, the idea of the response to the monuments. How do you look at that issue? And then, of course, tell us how you're laying the groundwork for a state-by-state movement that unites black, white, brown, employed, unemployed, gay and straight, documented and undocumented, religious and secular. How do we create, and how are you doing the work on that fusion movement to address our nation's wounds and produce public policy that's morally defensible, constitutionally consistent, and economically sane?
Oh, you've been reading that, huh?
I plagiarized entirely from the Reverend Barber.
You certainly have to do more than send a tweet out and have a rally. You know, rallies are good, but they're not enough now. And rallies on just special days do not prove organizing. So we're doing 15 regional trainings where states are coming together, and we have core anchor groups that are committed to this that are in 2 days of organizing training, understanding the times we're in, understanding what moral fusion organizing is. And then they're going back into their communities and organize, because one of the things I share with them is you helicopter leadership cannot do it. You know, it's amazing to me how we misinterpret history sometimes. People think, you know, Dr. King said, come to Washington, D.C., and folk came to hear him speak. No. There were 600 cities where people were incarcerated doing civil disobedience around the country. There was organizing going on. Bayard Rustin, the union man, was the deep organizer around all of this. A. Philip Randolph, they were organizing. And we forget that Dr. King then said at the end of his speech, he did not say, okay, let's come back to D.C. next year. He said, go back to Alabama, go back to Mississippi. He gave the orders. Go back and nationalize your state. Go, in other words, nationalize the issues in your state. And we have to remember that change didn't come from D.C. down. It came from Selma up. It came from Birmingham up. So we're going into these cities and training. That's why I'm in Detroit. We're doing 3 states tomorrow. We were in Albuquerque, New Mexico a few weeks ago. We did 3 states there. We were in Topeka, Kansas. We did 2 states there. We were in Kentucky. We had black and white, young and old, and gay and straight in Kentucky, from West Virginia, from Tennessee, from Appalachia. That's how we're doing it, slow and methodical. Not trying to organize everybody. Remember, Dr. King said in the original Poor People's Campaign, if he could just get 3,000 people that would work together in unity, would stay in the nation's capital, would engage, would live, would do civil disobedience, he could fundamentally shift the narrative in this country. He was shot. Evidently, it must have been possible and powerful. Otherwise, I do not believe he would have been assassinated. And so we believe that this can happen. It is happening. We're doing hard organizing. We're holding mass meetings. We've already signed up hundreds of people at every regional meeting we have. We've got 12 more to go across the country. You've got to build a group of people who can hold a movement and learn how to work, in intersectionality. And that takes me to your last point about these statues. Because there again, we have to approach that in a intersectional way. You know, the reality is the statues can come down and the statutes will still be up. You can actually be against hate and not be against white supremacy. And what I mean by that is you can be a politician and say you abhor someone driving through a crowd and killing a young lady and how bad that is, and I'm not like them. And at the same time, ignore how the policy and the words and the structures that you participate in actually embolden white supremacy and encourage it. And so one of the things in relation to Charlottesville, first of all, you have to understand what those statues represent. 80% of them were raised, as I said earlier, to celebrate the recodification of white supremacy. Then we have to say to politicians, yes, you should denounce the horrific death that occurred in Charlottesville. But that's not why Unite the Right went to Charlottesville. They went to Charlottesville and Richard Spencer and others like that because Steve Bannon was in the White House, and they saw that they had a sympathizer in the White House, both in the president and in the alt-right people that are in the White House. White nationalism and white supremacy has an agenda. They support ending DACA. They support sending immigrants out. They were are not for full health care for everyone. They don't believe in living wages. They believe that people that get those things are somehow people who shouldn't be entitled to them. And many times entitlement is a code word for black and brown. White supremacists do not really care about poor white people. They don't support policies that really lift up poor white people. They feed poor white people fear and rage and racism. And so if you're really against white supremacists are against the Voting Rights Act. White supremacy and white nationalism, they believe, they promote the lies that all these millions of people are voting, particularly minorities. So if you're against white supremacy, then the question for Trump or any politician, Democrat or Republican, will you vote to restore the Voting Rights Act? Will you vote for universal health care? Will you vote for living wages? Will you vote? Will you stop attacking our immigrant brothers and sisters? Will you vote against the wall? Because if not, then while you may denounce the horrific death of Heather and that kind of white supremacy, you are actually participating in the kind of policy provision that emboldens white supremacy, and you cannot have it both ways. You cannot have it both ways, because white supremacy and white nationalism is about an agenda. It is about transforming racism into policy. And until we talk about racism in that way, we've missed it. Racism is not just about interpersonal relationships. It is about systemic and the development of policies and structures that create disparate impact against black people, brown people. And listen, when instituted, hurt also more white people in raw numbers than it actually hurts black people. The denial of health care in my state, many of those that were against it blackenized the issue. They suggested, for instance, that Medicaid expansion was going to help those people. But do you know of the 500,000 people that would have gotten Medicaid expansion in North Carolina, Southern State, 360,000 of them were white. So more white people actually got hurt. And the people that hurt them got in office through racialized and racist voter suppression and gerrymandering tactics, and then use the racialized narrative to vote against Medicaid expansion. This is how we must impact, deal with the issue of racism and white supremacy. Yes, the statues ought to come down, but voter suppression has also got to come down. Having an attorney general who's the enemy of voting rights rather than the friend of voting rights has to change. We have to tear down the Electoral College, which is a remnant of white supremacy. We can't just bring down the statues. We have to bring down the statutes.
Well, Dr. William Barber is the founder and president of Repairers of the Breach, and I said one of the most influential progressive religious figures in the country. And I know that Building Bridges, I think I can speak for myself and Ken, are ready to enlist as drum majors in the fight.
I thought we had already.
Okay. I'm renewing our pledge.
Okay.
Reverend Barbara, I appreciate during a grueling schedule you spending time with us, but it is thoroughly rewarding, and you are an excellent recruiter in the triad, as you put it, as Dr. King put it, against the triple evils of militarism, of poverty, and of discrimination. It is an absolute honor to speak with you, and I must tell people they must read the Third Reconstruction and Forward Together.
Thank you. Yeah, and you know, Forward Together gives the history of the Moral Monday movement over the first 14 weeks. It's a manual it's an operations manual. And the Third Reconstruction, I wrote that, and the person that helped edit it used to be, talk about bringing people together, Jonathan Wilson Hargrove worked for Strom Thurmond and was raised in all of this extremism and had a fundamental shift of theology and mindset, and is now working directly, he and I are working directly together, moving across the country. So when I talk, I'm not talking merely hypotheses. I'm talking really, you know, about what's possible. And I'm so thankful that you would allow us to come on. I have one favor.
Yes, sir.
In December, we have brought together economists, poor people, working people, theologians, historians, onto a team to write this Souls of Poor Folks audit. We have an Institute for Policy Studies. The Urban Institute is going to work with us and some others, because I do not believe in knee-jerk reaction to civil disobedience, and nor can you believe in, I don't believe in being loud and being wrong. I think you ought to footnote what you say. And so that audit is going, the first executive summary is going to be released in December. It's going to lay out where we are and why we have to launch this Poor People's Campaign, and why we have to engage in a season of targeted nonviolence to drive a different narrative forward in this country in order to break through the tweets and the emails. I want to ask the favor that when we do that, that the chairs of that audit be able to come on your show and share with people this agenda, the Souls of Poor Folks agenda, because we don't want to just be cursing the darkness. We want to also say that that we have light and possibility, but and that this is something that has to be done and can be done. So I want to ask that when December rolls around, maybe they can come back on your show and
Definitely.
Talk about the audit.
Well, we insist. We insist. This is not a favor. This is a pleasure. This is part of our mandate to lift up the souls of poor folks and to pay homage to the organizers who are out there daily for peace and justice against militarism, poverty, and discrimination. The Reverend William Barber, you're very special, and you are very special to spend this time with us.
Well, thank you so much. God bless you to all of your listeners, and just keep us in your prayers, keep us in your thoughts, and thank you for everything that your station, this show, does to continue to keep alive the voice of truth and the voice of justice and the voice of love. God bless you.
Thank you so much for all you do.
Now, an excerpt from a speech by the Reverend William Barber. When silence is not an option, a message to the nation on rekindling a moral vision for justice, movement building, and social change.
We need a fresh wind. Language and vision or illumination and fire are important. But the text says the first thing that happened was the wind. We need a new moral fusion movement blowing in every community across this land. Same folk who are attacking public schools, attack health care, the same ones do that, attack the LGBT community, the same ones that do that, attack labor, attack Muslims, attack the immigrants, attack voting rights, attack living wages. And if they're cynical enough to blow a foul wind, then we have to be courageous and yielded enough to be a part of a fresh wind. Because America needs more than a strategy to win back some seats for Democrats in 2018. We need a new moral Pentecostal wind that begins to blow against racism and poverty and the war economy. We need a wind that will blow us right out of this chapel, right down south, right in the Rust Belt, right in the Wheat Belt, and even in the places of New York that some people feel are off limits. We need the kind of wind that blew them out of that upper room, and they were no longer afraid of that Caesar who loved to build towers. They were no longer afraid of that Herod who built and put his money on face on the faces of the corn. And I'm convinced that some of what we're seeing is the last gasp of an order that is passing away. Pentecost in Acts tells us that 2,000 years ago, people were impressed by folks speaking in other tongues that weren't their own. Tongues got the ears' attention. The fire caught the eyes' attention. But the real miracle of that day was the wind blew people together that otherwise would be torn apart. One writer says to us in this moment, he says, the combination of economic anxiety, the insatiable greed of the Koch brothers and their ilk, and a barely subliminal racism against a black man serving in our country as president set the stage for what we see now. And then Donald Trump appropriated much of Sanders' rhetoric about Wall Street, bankers, billionaires, and the globalized economy. He added his own Trumpian vitriol against immigrants, African Americans, Muslims, gangs, drug dealers, and women. And to many people, they bought the con. But history shows that just getting rid of Trump will not fix everything that has gone wrong. Focusing on his obvious personality disorders may be entertaining, but it's not a winning strategy. This is a historical moment of realignments and transformations here and around the world. There's a fire wind, and Donald Trump is merely a symptom. And so we need a fresh wind. One of the first ways we be a part of a fresh wind is when a few weeks ago we announced the Souls of Poor Folk, auditing America since the Poor People's Campaign's challenge on racism, poverty, war, and national morality. You don't pass the 50th anniversary of a prophet's death without evaluating what the prophet stood for, where you are and where you aren't. And once you figure out where you aren't, the only way you can honor the prophet is to pick up from there and move forward. We are praying that this audit will begin to blow a fresh wind. We've got economists and poor people and historians and preachers and clergy sitting on this panel doing seriously. Where are we? What? Not in the last 4 years, but in the last 50 years. Not Democrat or Republican, but let's examine the very foundations and the factors that have impacted America on what should be our deepest moral concerns: economic sustainability and poverty, health care, education, environmental justice, women's rights, criminal justice reform, the proliferation of guns, voting rights, immigrant justice, not just immigrant rights, immigrant justice. Where are we? And then, because we can't just have a piece of an audit, we've got to have a movement. And so we believe in this moment we've got to not just keep the focus on Trump, but we've got to focus on how do we challenge these systems that create these symptoms. And so we must have a revival, a reimagination, an implementation of the Poor People's Campaign. We can no longer just go and have memorials and commemoration services. That's not how you honor prophets and prophetic movements. We must resurrect and embrace the vision. And we need a new Poor People's Campaign made up of clergy and poor people and artists and academics and people of every race and every gender to come together. And we need a season of resistance, not intermittent marches, but a season of resistance. What would happen if we had 40 days, let's just say in 2018? What about starting on Mother's Day, 40 days? And what if we had clergy, Jewish and Muslim and imams and Poor people leading groups of 25 or 50 into state capitals, and then groups of 100 going straight into the Capitol, not only outside in Washington, D.C., but right over to Ryan's office and right over to McConnell's office. And if we had an agenda out of this audit, and what if we began to sit down and every day they had to arrest us for 40 days? And what if we took a part of the poor people's campaign, but where they went to D.C. and set up camp, what if we set up camp in 25 states and camp in the District of Columbia? And what if Union had three of those days where the president and students and others would lead something into the Capitol in Ryan? What if every seminary across the country holding hands with poor people and people without health care and immigrants? I mean, what if... Yeah, Dr. King had us on the way, had us in the way. The system killed him on the way, and now it's time for us to find a way. We need to find a way to finish. Somebody said, well, what difference will it do? Well, I know one thing. If that many people get arrested for that many days, it's going to at least change the narrative. First, you have to have moral imagination, prophetic imagination, and then you get prophetic implementation, and so we need it, and so we are committed, and I hope you will join us. You can go to breachrepairers.org and begin to sign up, but we've got to build a movement that has some wind, that has some ruach, that began to shake the foundations of this nation. That's bigger than one president, but it's about principle. It's about changing the trajectory of the nation. It's not just a Democratic wind or a Republican wind or independent wind, but a moral wind. And I believe it's time right now to 2018. If we do it right, we'll birth a movement that'll last another 15 or 20 years. We have to do it. We've got to have this new tongue and new fire, and we've got to have a movement that puts a new wind beneath the knee. What if for just 40 days everybody could stay in their silos? You know, Black Lives Matter could do their thing, women could do their thing, environmentalists could do their thing for the other 325 days. But for 40 days, we decide to walk together, children, huh? And decide to not be weary. You know, I think we can do it. Not because I just am, you know, an optimist. I am hopeful. I don't have to walk by faith altogether on this. I can walk by sight. Every major social movement in this nation has ever been won is because somebody came together and created a new wind. I feel a wind blowing. It's going to blow down south. It's going to blow all over America. We are not going to let the prophet's dream die. It's to... There's a new wind blowing.
Reverend William Barber with the Moral Mondays Movement, Repairers of the Breach, President of the North Carolina NAACP. This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.